The same sort of situation is here again. It's not as good as 2009, just to be clear. But I think that there's a significant opportunity today to buy cheaper assets. And most of you are not going to do it because of fear. And while investors enjoy telling each other the famous Warren Buffett quote, which is, when others are greedy, be fearful. And when others are fearful, be greedy, right? Well, obviously then Warren Buffett thinks it's time to be greedy at this point in time because everyone else is fearful. But I think most of you will still not follow that process.
That was Neil Bawa. Neil's a returning guest to the show, and he's a data scientist that uses data to find markets and opportunities that we've never heard of. Well, in the last episode, he talked about his strategy and how he was finding these markets. And in this episode, here we are in early 2023, he talks about how he's had to change his strategy, but still use data science to find great opportunities. Now, I was on the road when I recorded this episode, so the audio quality is not up to where it usually is, but I thought the conversation was so worth it that I wanted to make sure that we got it out there as soon as possible. It's a great show. Stay tuned. I think you'll enjoy it.
The limited partner shares in the potentially outsized returns of a well-planned and executed investment, but as a passive investor, and has the maximum leverage on their most precious asset, their time. And that is why we're here together. 90% of the millionaires out there built their net worth with real estate. However, 0% of the billionaires are hands-on managing the real estate assets because there simply isn't enough time. My name is Jake Wiley, and for the past 16 years, I've been investing in real estate, and I've learned a thing or two. But the most important lesson is how to leverage the expertise and time of others to maximize your investment potential. Welcome to the Limited Partner Podcast.
All right, welcome partners back for another episode. You may recognize Neil from a prior episode. He is a returning guest. I think he's got an incredible story and a different way that he looks at the market. This week, I really want to kind of dig in with you, Neil, on what your feelings are and thoughts are on how to kind of work through this interesting market. But first and foremost, thank you and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back in such interesting times.
It is interesting to say the least. I guess for the benefit of my listeners out there that, you know, didn't get you on the first show, if you wouldn't mind, if you just give us a real quick background on you, Grow Capitus, all the things that you're looking at now, and then we'll jump into the show.
Sure. I'm a technologist, so computer science degree. I have a data science background, and I look at everything in terms of numbers and in terms of raw data. Have had a successful tech career, had a successful tech exit, invested in real estate for 10 years without any limited partners, just my own money. Enjoyed the incredible tax benefits because I live in California and I was paying more than 50% a year in taxes. And over by the end of those 10 years when my technology company was sold, I eventually jumped into real estate on a full-time basis. I have a very popular course called Location Magic that is a real estate data science course. Currently, there's 11,500 people taking that course on Udemy, udemy.com. So if you type in Udemy space Neil Bawa, you'll see the course. And then we've expanded upon that course, made it, you know, internally, we use a lot more metrics on it. And we use that to both buy and build properties of different kinds, multifamily, student housing, industrial, self-storage throughout the United States. Properties are in 10 states. We currently have a little shy of 1,000 investors investing with us. The portfolio is about $1 billion and has about 4,800 units. In the end, though, while I can say that I'm a syndicator and a real estate guy, I mostly believe I'm a data scientist still using data science to exploit gaps in the marketplace, figure out where to go in the next 3 or 4 years. And that really hasn't changed much.
Yeah, I think the whole concept of data science, especially in this market, is so important. I guess let's talk a little bit about that and how you're using that in the current environment and how that's helping.
Well, sure. The current environment is probably the most challenging that I've seen for data science because what I'm, you know, the typical indicators that I'm used to are not working very well. So the usual indicators are population, job growth, home price growth, income growth, you know, schools and crime reduction, things like that sort of make sense. 99% of the time are not making sense today. So I've been forced to pivot to metrics like affordability. I've been forced to pivot to metrics like, you know, where is home price growth dropping the least? So we've had, you know, boom markets and so many good markets that I've talked about in the last 10 years, none of them really doing well. I mean, Austin, Phoenix, you know, the other Texan markets, with the exception of Florida, pretty much all of the markets in the US that are considered to be fundamentally strong or have strong momentum are not doing well. So we're basically having to look for gaps in the marketplace. Today, we are very price-driven. So we're in an odd sort of way, Jake. Today, we are the least data science-based than we have been since 2014. And the reason for that is price. Today, price discounts in the multifamily industry have gone from, you know, a range from somewhere between 15 to 25%. So we're mostly interested in markets where the price discounts are a bit higher. Because, I mean, on a $30 million property, when you get a 25% discount, you basically made $6 or $7 million up front. You may not get the cash flow benefit of that today because of high interest rates, but that money is made. It, by the time you sell 5 or 6 years from now, you'll thank yourself for buying at that level. So oddly enough, today I'm more focused on price sensitivity than I am on other things. And it's data science that's pointing me towards that. It's data science that's saying the weightage of population growth, job growth, income growth is lower today in the last 12 months than it was before. And the weightage of affordability, which is such a key metric, you know, in a high interest rate environment, that weightage has increased. The price sensitivity, you know, what kind of a discount you're getting, that has a higher sensitivity today. So things have changed a great deal for me. I have no doubt at all that at some point, let's call it 12 or 18 months from now, I'll go back to my old formula and those weightages will go back up today. But today, affordability is what matters. Affordability of price, affordability of rents is what matters. And that's where we're seeing the greatest opportunity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And one thing I've always liked about your investing methodology is that you're not just following on the coattails of everybody else, right? Like you mentioned these major markets that everybody's been in. And a lot of it's been institutional driven. And, you know, I think on our last podcast, one of the quotes is like, I'm doing deals in markets you probably never heard of and making more money than you are. And I think that's, is that still, you know, using the data science, are you still finding kind of niche markets, or is the affordability, is kind of your new model, is it forcing you back towards more mainstream-ish markets or on the fringes, or how has that changed the markets that you're looking at?
For the moment, yes. Those niche markets, Jake, that, you know, we talked about in the last podcast, they haven't dropped as much in pricing because they were affordable markets, because their rents are in the $1,000, $1,100, $1,200 range. And whereas some of these, you know, kind of hotter markets, rents were in the $1,300, $1,400, $1,500 range. And so we haven't seen enough of a price drop in those niche markets. And I'm still interested in them. I'm hoping today I sign a contract on a property that I'm buying in Tallahassee, downtown Tallahassee. Florida is doing really well as a state. Tallahassee is actually a market that typically doesn't do as well as the rest of Florida, and it's now catching up. So I'm excited about that. But I'm not buying it at that 25% discount. I'm getting a smaller discount. Let's just call it somewhere between 12 and 15%. So what's really happening is that some of these gateway markets that I've stayed away from, right? Last time on my podcast, I was saying, I'm staying away from all these big markets. Well, now yeah. I'm taking another look at them because the discounts there make those markets almost as attractive as my unknown markets. Almost, the key word being almost. And I think that I need another 6 months to go by, and maybe in 6 months I'm back on your podcast and I'll say it's equivalent. You know, on the one side, I have these unknown markets with potential for significant, you know, increase in the future. And on the other side, I have these growth markets that everybody knows where the discounts are high enough for me to re-engage. So the market that I think the discounts are high enough for me to start re-engaging on in the next 3 months is Phoenix. I do not believe any of the other growth markets are cheap enough for me to re-engage yet.
Well, that's really interesting. And, you know, maybe switching gears, but a similar topic here is that, you know, we're starting to see deals that were purchased in the past, call it 3 years, start to find some distress, right? Which is obviously what's creating some of these discounts. And, you know, a lot of you out there, my listeners, are really writing in and saying, look, how do we navigate that, right? I'm starting to see, you know, areas where our preferred returns have gone away, or there's the potential for capital calls. What is your advice for investors and the investors that you work with right now? What should they be watching out for? What are you doing differently?
Honestly, I'm just going to, you know, I'm now speaking to your LP investors, right? It's too late for you to watch out. I think that if you invested in half a dozen properties in the last 2 years and those properties were purchased at 3 cap or 4 cap, I have no advice for you. I mean, in those 2 years where my contemporaries bought 6, 7, 8, or 10 properties, I bought one. And I bought that one property at a 5 cap in a remote metro called Killeen, Texas. Most people haven't even heard of Killeen, Texas, by the way. And so I couldn't buy any properties in the last two and a half years. If you've made those investments in the last two and a half years, I don't have really any advice for you. At this point, I will just cross my fingers and hope that your syndicators are able to find a way forward. Even though I believe that 40% of those properties that were purchased in that time frame are going to eventually end up going back to the bank after lots of painful cash calls and other mechanisms and rescue funds and things like that, they're still going to lose about 40% of those. And it is what it is, that the prices that were paid are just unviable today. My advice for you today, oddly enough, is tied to today. It's not tied to the past. So 18 months ago, you saw this offer when somebody was like, okay, you know, I'm buying this property at 3.5 cap, which, by the way, is a very high price. Remember, the lower the cap rate, the higher the price. And you felt like you should invest in it because the market was good and everyone was making money in real estate. I'm not sure that was a good thing for you to do. But today, why would you not want to invest in real estate? Today doesn't make any sense for you not to invest, because if you're an investor, you're not a speculator. Speculators invest just because the market is going up. Investors invest just because the market is cheap. Well, it's cheap and getting cheaper. So using the dollar cost averaging method that people used for stock market investment, I'd start making investments today and I would make them for at least the next 18 months. And I am very strong belief that multifamily prices will go down and then bottom out perhaps in the Q1 or Q2 of next year, and then they'll start going up. But even today, you're getting a discount. So even today, when an investment is being made by you into a property, you're getting a discount. But today, what I find is 9 out of 10 investors are freaked out. Why? Because they're seeing cash calls on what they did 18 months ago. So they're missing out the opportunity again. After promising themselves that what they did in 2009, which was basically fear-based, you didn't go out and do what I did, but I went out and bought as many single family homes as I could. I bought as many as I could for my sister-in-law, my mother-in-law. I bought just whatever I could get my hands on. And I was delighted that no one else was interested in buying them at that point of time because I was making enormous amounts of cash flow and appreciation. The same sort of situation is here again. It's not as good as 2009, just to be clear. But I think that there's a significant opportunity today to buy cheaper assets. And most of you are not going to do it because of fear. And while investors enjoy telling each other the famous Warren Buffett quote, which is, when others are greedy, be fearful. And when others are fearful, be greedy, right? Well, obviously then Warren Buffett thinks it's time to be greedy at this point in time because everyone else is fearful. But I think most of you will still not follow that process. If I could give you the advice, the answer is read books from Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and people that basically invest based on value, not based on momentum. Because today there is no momentum in the marketplace. I don't think that it's going to be momentum for 18 months. Today is a value investment marketplace, not just in real estate. There's actually some stocks that have some opportunity there as well. And so my advice to you would be become a value investor right now. Try to erase from your mind what happened to you in the last 24 or 18 months, whatever happened. There's really nothing you can do as an LP investor to change that, the past. What you can do is be more data-driven, be more of an investor, be less of a speculator today. I think it'll lead you down the right path.
Well, there's actually a couple of things that you brought up there in that last little session or segment there that I want to talk about. One, the first one is the dollar cost averaging aspect of it. And I recently interviewed Jeremy Roll, and one of the points he made was, you know, there's something to timing in diversification, right? Just because you have cash today doesn't mean that you should invest all of it today. So, you know, I think what I heard you kind of talking about was investing kind of over time so that, you know, you are getting this quote unquote dollar cost averaging cycle out of your investments and not just saying, okay, well, look, I've got, call it, just make a bigger number. I've got $100,000 I need to invest. Like, don't go put $100,000 in an investment tomorrow, right? Work through and, like, you know, bite it off in chunks, see how far you can get it, spread it out a little bit so that you are getting the benefit of, yes, you may go down a little bit, but like, you'll also be investing in a depressed market, right? So as the curve goes back up, like, you'll pick it back up. Like, did I get that right?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, what's interesting is, on the one hand, dollar cost averaging, this is a good time to be doing that because the market is declining. Dollar cost averaging is something that you usually do where you, when, if the market is declining or at risk of declining, you buy as it declines. So every time it goes down, you don't go out and panic and sell, you actually buy more. because you're going to average out over time. And so I'm suggesting that if you're making multifamily investments, make smaller investments, but continue to invest, because at least you're locking in a discount today, and you'll regret not having that discount if you don't invest. You might have less money to invest today. Most people do, compared to 18 months ago. That's not a reason to not be an investor. If you're an investor and not a speculator, you're looking to invest today. Having said that, the money is no longer burning a hole in your pocket. If you're not earning 4% risk-free interest on your money in the bank right now today, something is wrong. Please look at Citi. Please look at Comerica. There's lots of banks offering, you know, money market liquid accounts where, you know, you're earning 4% interest and still have access to your money at any point of time. So the money should no longer be burning a hole in your pocket. You should be patient. You know, I don't think that we are in the end game yet. We're just sort of entering the mid game of this crisis. So give yourself the chance to continue to buy through the mid game and through the end game. And then 5 years from now, you can brag about these things.
The other thing that you brought up, which I think is interesting because it plays together, is you said something like 40% of the deals that are purchased in the last handful of years are probably going to go back to the bank. And I think that the potential, I guess, downward cycle of prices, when banks own properties, like they're not really allowed to own properties, right? And they need to dispose of those. And therefore, it continues to put pressure on the valuation because they've got to get them off their balance sheets. You think of it as an asset, they think of it as a liability when they have that, right? So banks look as a loan, that's an asset. Property is a liability. So what happens when 40% of those properties go back to the bank? I see, like, you know, the bottom could actually fall out of the market. And that's something that I think is actually real.
There's a tendency to believe that. So I want to first qualify that. Okay, so the multifamily market in the United States is very large. There's tons and tons of people sitting on fixed loans. None of them will sell anything in the next 18 months. They'll just sit there. They'll do nothing with their properties. They'll earn their rents. So a very substantial portion of the entire multifamily market is fine simply because there's some kind of a fixed loan that's happening, or their income has increased so much over the last 2 or 3 years because, you know, rents were crazy in 2021. There were massive increases that the property is cash flowing anyway. So they have no incentive to do anything about it except just sit there. So imagine, let's call it 70 or 80% of the market that's like that, right? I'll say 70%. So what I'm really talking about, when I say 40%, I don't mean 40% of the whole multifamily market. So I stand corrected on that. I mean 40% of the properties that were purchased using floating rate debt in 2021 and 2022. 2023, it's too soon, so I won't use that year. So 2021, 2022, if you purchased properties using floating rate debt and you bought them in that low cap range, let's call it sub 4 cap, 40% of those properties are likely to go back into the bank. What percentage is that of the overall market? I would speculate I'm talking about 10%, maybe even less. Now, that 40% is not going to go back into the bank next quarter. Some of these properties will go back into the bank next quarter. Some are going to continue going back to the bank over the next 2 years. So think of this as a very slow moving process, right? So this distress that you were talking about, Jake, only builds up if a very large number of them go back to the bank at the same time. And some of them, the banks will also reach arrangements. I don't have a sense of what percentage of them. The banks learned a lot from 2008, by the way. They know that taking back a bunch of properties is not a wise idea. So if there are deals to be made at the last minute there, deals will be made in this case, because this is not 2008 where the properties are declined 70%. Properties are declining by 15, 20, or 25%, depending upon the marketplace, which still means that if cash flow can be used as a way to kind of kick the can down the road, it will get kicked. So I fundamentally believe that all that's going to happen is that prices will decline because these properties are going back to the marketplace. Bottom falling out from the marketplace? No, because there's an enormous amount of equity sitting on the sidelines that just wants a better price. They want a bigger discount. And there's, from what I can tell, hundreds of billions of dollars of money that's patiently sitting on the sidelines and waiting. Well, then that capital starts coming back into the marketplace once a substantial amount of further discounting has occurred, and it stabilizes the marketplace. The other thing that stabilizes it is time, right? It's not all triggering at the same time. Some of it, that you can kick the can down this the road for a year. Some of it you can kick it down for 2 years. So you know, please understand my 40% number seems more ominous than it actually is.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that, because I was thinking that's a lot. And then really maybe taking it into let's go into another asset class. I want to talk about office for a second, because
sure.
Office, on the other hand, is in a world of hurt. And there's a lot that's going to happen. And I think that's, you know, the banks are going to own a significant portion of office buildings. And what are your thoughts? And I mean, maybe you don't really have a lot, but like, what are your thoughts on the impact of office on the broader CRE kind of marketplace?
I think that the office impact is so phenomenal and so massive that I think that at some point, 18 to 24 months from now, I believe the government will have to step in and help in some fashion, because the office situation is actually very similar to what happened in 2008, 2009 with single family and with mortgage-backed securities. That's where office is, right? That's where office is today. And the only reason you're not hearing more about it, though I'm beginning to see headlines now, so that's good. I mean, Bloomberg, the other day, I noticed that there were two headlines about the office situation. So what's really happened is that 10% of the companies that used to have offices didn't come back to the office. They just stayed on as, you know, remote companies. And that's a trend. Usually younger, smaller companies did that. The larger companies went back to the office, but they're now giving their employees flexibility to come to the office 3 days a week. And they're using shared desks. So where before you used to have a desk of your own, now you have a shared desk. And what they're saying is, well, you can't every week take Monday and Friday off. Some weeks you're going to take Tuesday and Wednesday off. Some weeks you can take Monday and Friday off. So we can rotate those people and use 2/3 of the office space. And because office space was so expensive in 2018, 2019, 2020, the people that paid for that office space, they paid so much money that if they get 70, 75% occupancy, then we're not talking, you remember I said 10% of multifamily might be at risk of going back to the bank. I think 1/3 of all office space in the United States is at risk of going back to the bank. Now it's a very slow moving debacle, even slower moving than multifamily, because typically office tenants sign longer leases, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, very common. Very few leases are 1 year and 2 year leases. So as a result, it takes a long time for those leases to come up for renewal. And those companies don't want their credit to be hurt, so they're continuing to pay for this office space that's sort of empty or half empty. It's also by city. San Francisco is the hardest one hit. Miami is the least hit. So there's different markets that are going to be hit to different levels. But we're looking at a $200 to $300 billion debacle, where mid-market banks, and these are the banks that are hurting the most from the Silicon Valley Bank disaster, those are the banks that are at most exposed. 40% of all office loans in the United States, especially in the mid-market, 40% were small to mid-sized banks. Well, these are the banks that lost billions of dollars of deposits in the last 60 days to big banks. So the banks are smaller, they're supposed to lend less, and now the Fed is also forcing them to write down the value of these office assets that they've lent to. This is called mark-to-market. When they do a mark-to-market, then those assets are worth a lot less, which forces the bank to shrink further. So it puts the bank into a spiral. If there is one thing that can cause contagion in the US banking system today, it is the collapse of the office sector. It's not anything else. It's real estate, again, that is likely to cause contagion. Luckily, we still have time, because a lot of these office buildings, their leases are not renewing. You know, there's not a huge number that are renewing in 2013, but by the end of 2013 and beginning of 2024, there is a ton of them, a little over $1 trillion if you consider all commercial assets, not just office, but office is hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't think any of those gets renewed. I don't think that there's any mathematical case for any lender to agree to renew those.
Yeah, I appreciate you explaining that. I've been kind of sounding the alarm on the podcast a little bit for the office space. And really, the point you made about the government having to step in and intervene, like, I totally agree. And I think that one of the things I've actually encouraged our listeners to do is call in to your local senator, you know, and representative, and just say, hey, like, can you at least just pay attention to this? Know that there's some concern here, because if they act sooner rather than later, because like once it starts to fall apart, to your point, like we're in contagion stage. And yes, they can step in and do stuff, and we're talking bailouts. But if they start figuring out plans for workouts earlier, it's the earlier they get it, the better we're going to be. because I, like you, believe that the office market is artificial. Like, it's already in trouble, right? We're seeing significant value decreases in the office space, but it's arbitrarily being propped up by leases that, you know, 5-7 year leases, 3-5-7 year leases that we've seen in the office space that are still out there, right? So the offices look in the marketplace to everybody, you know, to the banks, to everybody, slightly higher, you know, the occupancy looks higher than it really is. Because at the end of the day, like you said, these businesses are going to turn around and say, all right, lease is up. We don't need all this space. Like, yes, we're turning it in. I mean, I agree with your number. I think it's 30, probably 40% of the office space out there, like, will never be leased again. And the other point that you made, which I thought was really spot on, was that office was always the highest priced real estate asset, right? So, you know, there's all these folks out there in the market talking about, oh, we'll do office to, you know, multifamily conversion, office to storage. And it's like, you don't understand the valuations of where the office has started was already higher than a brand new, like, A-type, you know, multifamily property, right? So, like,
that's the challenge, right? I mean, I hear all this talk about conversions. I find it really highly dubious. There, to me, I think that less than 1% of the distressed office space in the U.S. is actually eligible for conversion or profitable conversion. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So the first reason is simply exactly what you said. I mean, the office space was purchased at a price higher than condos, higher than downtown multifamily. So when it was purchased higher than that, if you're converting it and you're spending tens of millions of dollars for converting it, who exactly is going to give you that money? Where is that money for conversion going to come from when the end product after the conversion still costs less than what you've paid for the existing product? Right? What value are you creating? So it's going to be very difficult to get funding for those projects from any lender because the lenders understand that the final product doesn't have sufficient value for them to lend on it. Second, it's a very difficult process. People think that, you know, you can just take an office and convert it into multifamily. It's extremely painful. It's extremely difficult. There's zoning issues. There are potentially some hotel conversions, but the problem is it's very difficult for hotel conversion because what's happening is downtown cores are seeing such high vacancy that the hotel demand is also down for the same reason. If there's less people going to the office, there's less people traveling to see them. And so hotel occupancy is down, so you don't need more hotels. So hotel conversion is problematic. Condo conversion, let's say even if the numbers work, same problem. Who was living in the condos? Well, the people that were going to the office were living in the condos and they were paying up for them. Well, now those people can actually live 20 miles away and come into the office, drive into the office 3 days a week. And many of them are leaving those cities. San Francisco is seeing incredible loss of these high earners. And so when that loss happens, the condo market that is pre-existing today is also getting hurt. And because it's getting hurt, it doesn't actually make sense to make more condos in a market that is losing momentum. So there are no solutions that I'm aware of for this office market. Conversions are certainly not a solution. I think we just go through a very serious, significant meltdown, and the market that is going to be the poster child of this meltdown is going to unquestionably be San Francisco.
And I guess one final question to kind of wrap this up is that, how do you marry, you know, the idea of continuing investing, knowing that we've got this office calamity coming our way, right? You know, because can it bring the whole system down, or like, what are your thoughts there?
I think it will significantly impact multifamily prices if it gets to, you know, full-on meltdown. There are solutions that are going to be found, but I think almost every solution requires the government to jump in and help in some shape or form. One of the things that could be possible is we basically go back and do a five-year property tax holiday for those offices. So by bringing their humongously high property taxes down for a five-year time frame, we allow the market to recover. And you say, what happens in 5 years? Well, the answer is no one's going to build office for 5 years. And so over time, now there's 5 years to convert. Now you can go through the conversion process and do it more slowly and cherry pick and, you know, figure it out. And plus over time, office space in the US does get demolished for other things all the time anyway. So if you don't build anything for 5 years, you will have equilibrium. So I think we need to find a way to create equilibrium. I see the government, you know, coming in short of that happening. It will affect multifamily too. It'll affect all sorts of asset classes. That is why dollar cost averaging. No one knows how far multifamily will go down. Most good markets are down 12, 15, 16, 18%. Some markets down in the 20s. And we could easily go down another 7, 8, 9%. My point is, fundamentals for multifamily are not like office. Fundamentals are strong, very strong. Because of what's happening to interest rates, builders across the U.S. cannot build single-family homes anymore as often as they were. They're building 30% less. Well, we build 800,000 single-family homes in the U.S. every year. If you build 30% less, you're creating a 250,000 home deficit per year. If you do that for 2 years, that's 500,000 homes. Where will those people live? Multifamily. So if we can, once we get through this crisis, and remember the mantra of the multifamily industry, right? Survive to 2025. So all we have to do as an industry is survive, probably without cash flow, to 2025. And when we do, this hole that the single family market is digging of 500,000 units is going to help us with rent growth.
Well, Neil, that was fascinating. And I like the mantra, survive to 2025. I might rip that off and use that on future episodes. That's great. But is there anything else you think, you know, you would need for this episode to be complete?
Just want to go back to the mindset. Every time there's fear, investors walk away. And then every time that the party starts again, they wonder why they walked away. So it's not about us. It's not about Jake. It's not about Neil. It's about your mindset. Are you fear-based or are you truly value-based?
Awesome. Well, Neil, this has been a great show. Thank you for coming on. And I guess, how can my listeners find you?
I happen to be the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web, so you can type in my first name and last name and hit enter. We also have a university website called multifamilyu.com. About 26,000 people sign up for our webinars. We do webinars on all of the matters that we talked about today, single family, multifamily, commercial real estate. We do webinars on all of those. So you're welcome to sign those up. There's no subscription. There's no fees. There's no upsell. It's just a site where people gather to talk about all things multifamily. So that's multifamilyu.com.
Awesome. Well, Neil, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and I'd actually love for you to contribute to a future episode. If you have a question you'd like answered or a topic or a guest to bring on the show, please email me at jake@thelimitedpartner.com. Now I realize there is a lot of lingo that's thrown around on these shows, so I've created a cheat sheet for you with the top 26 terms that come up most often. Head on over to thelimitedpartner.com/lingo for the list. Enjoy, and we'll see you next time.